Mr. Hillis.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent the defendant appellant Robert Pritchard. We've raised several issues on appeal. To begin, Mr. Pritchard's Fifth Amendment right to due process was violated when he was denied the right to confront adverse witnesses. Accusatory statements from Pamela Pritchard were made, as were accusatory statements offered in the documentation from medical personnel, as well as various police officers. Mr. Pritchard should have had the opportunity to cross-examine those witnesses. He was not given it. Beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Why?
Because the Fifth Amendment provides a right to...
And under our laws, our rules...
You surely don't want to rely on the Fifth Amendment. You have to rely on the rule. Your Fifth Amendment argument has been rejected in prior decisions. Why don't you just discuss the rule?
The rule is... A reduction of the Fifth Amendment protection, so we relied on both.
No, it's a rule. It's not a restatement of the Constitution.
I'll focus on the rule, Your Honor. The rule provides that defendants are entitled to the right to cross-examine adverse witnesses. Rule 32.1b2c.
No, it doesn't say that. It says they're entitled to cross-examine unless the district court makes a finding.
Beg your pardon, Your Honor.
I was getting to the rule as it is written.
Yes, Your Honor. I was getting to the qualifiers. In this case, the qualifiers were not met because the government did not show that it was unable to bring in the witnesses.
It's not a question of what the prosecutor shows. The rule refers to a finding by the judge, not to a showing by the prosecutor.
There was no finding.
Did anybody ask the judge to make a finding under the rule? Did anybody draw the rule to the district judge's attention?
Yes, Your Honor. Transcript pages 14 to 16. In that, we asked the court to make a specific finding. We cited the Eighth Circuit's opinion, United States versus Johnson. Upon doing so and stating the three-factor test that was used in Johnson with respect to Rule 32.1b2c, the district court said, motion denied. There's no further analysis.
Well, the court didn't mention that Mrs. Pritchard was afraid and didn't want to appear, right?
Your Honor, that was much later in the proceedings. When this issue came up, there was no statement by the prosecutor that she was afraid, and furthermore, the facts did not support that she was unafraid. The prosecutor said to the court, this case is provable without her, so we elected not to call her. The court did not engage in any determination about the reliability of the evidence. The government has in the past submitted the evidence to the court for a predetermination on reliability. It did so in the case United States versus Wallace, which is a pending matter in this court now. Skewing that procedure, the government instead offered the evidence to the court, vouched that it was reliable. The court accepted it into evidence. There was no determination made that any of the witnesses were unable to come, that the evidence itself was reliable, and that therefore the government should be excused from calling in the necessary witnesses and the court could rely on the evidence. None of that was done. Mr. Pritchard should have had the opportunity to cross-examine the adverse witnesses under the rule. The statements that were contained in the materials received by the district court were unreliable, and there are numerous cases that talk about the relationship between the alleged victim and the alleged batterer or the individual, rather, who is appearing at the revocation hearing, such that the statements of the alleged victim are not entitled to any particular reliability. In fact, they have been deemed unreliable in United States versus Comito, which was a Ninth Circuit case, and there's also a Third Circuit case which raised a similar issue. Those cases, especially the third case, was a more recent rejection of the idea that the reliability test is still good law in light of Rule 32.1b2c and the 2002 amendments to it. The government knew it should have called in the witnesses. It didn't. The witnesses, in particular, Mrs. Pritchard, was not a reliable witness. We tried to argue that to the district court. We would have been able to cross-examine her about the reliability of her statements. Her statements infused the evidence throughout this case. By relying on that material, the government was able to convince the court of the grade A violation of supervised release. without that evidence, there's insufficient proof of aggravated domestic battery because we don't have any statements from Mrs. Pritchard that could be considered. We have only then police reports that reduce to writing things that she said, the nature of her injuries, how the injuries were sustained. There's no determination by the district court either about the lack of legal justification by Mr. Pritchard insofar as there was an altercation between the two individuals and the injuries then that resulted to Mrs. Pritchard. All of these things make the determination by the district court of the grade A violation infirm. We do not know, other than Mrs. Pritchard's statements, which again are throughout the evidence offered by the government, but it is hearsay, and I understand that Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 1001 allows for the consideration of hearsay, but it has to be reliable hearsay under the case law. And Rule 32.1 does not allow them to bring in this type of evidence. So, as for whether Mr. Pritchard battered her, whether there was a lack of legal justification, the type of injury that was sustained, the extent of the injury, we do not know this information, at least by competent evidence. Moving on to the policy range.
So your position would be that it was that we would ignore the various statements that she made immediately after the beatings, which could come in as excited utterances. We would ignore the hospital records that document her injuries. We would ignore her statements when she was seeking treatment, as well as the firsthand observations of the officers on the scene.
Respectfully, Your Honor, there were no excited utterance arguments made below, and so there should not be any consideration of that argument made here. The officers' observations, they could observe what Mrs. Pritchard looked like, but what she said and what they repeated about what she said, how she sustained the injuries, that doesn't come in. The medical evidence, United States versus Hall, the Ninth Circuit case, allowed the consideration of the medical evidence, but in that case, the adverse witness was unavailable. There was a finding of that. Nevertheless, the medical providers came in and testified. They were subject to cross-examination. Then their medical records were able to be introduced into evidence. That was not done here. The policy range in this case, and I have errantly referred to it as the sentencing guideline range, respectful of this court's recent decision, Ulanders-Patrick, it is a policy range, but it is a single range. And so far as the government says that there are two separate violations of supervised release, and so the methodology is to correctly calculate each violation and then pile 46 months on top of 46 months, that is contrary to United States Sentencing Guideline 7B1.1b. There is a single range for the violation. Policy range in this case, if there's a grade A violation, we contest that there is, but it is one single range. That range is the appropriate penalty under the policy statements. It's entitled to great weight, and that's Rule United States Sentencing Guideline 7B1.4. Yet in this case, the district court imposed 92 months imprisonment, gave twice the low end of the guideline range. And insofar as the government's brief says it's perplexed how we arrived at this position that 92 months is twice the low end of the guideline range, 7B1.1b. The additional arguments that we make with respect to grouping and considerations of those sort are really secondary with respect to what the guideline itself provides at 7B1.1. The doubling of the policy range is problematic here since the range is to promote uniformity and fair sentencing and thereby eliminating disparities. Doubling the range creates a disparity absent sufficient explanation why the penalty imposed is warranted. I don't believe that was sufficiently done here. Last, we've argued, and I believe that the law supports us on this, that the district court erred by relying on disputed police reports and erroneous information. The disputed police reports are important to note that they are disputed because, in fact, the government says that they were not disputed, but we disputed those at page 60 in the transcript. So the government's reliance on the Lopez-Hernandez case is problematic. Mrs. Pritchard never stated that she was too afraid to testify, so that is incorrect insofar as the district court said that. I refer, Your Honors, to the transcript pages. And then lastly, evidence containing Pamela Pritchard's statements themselves are, again, unreliable statements, and so the district court should not have relied on those in imposing the 92-month sentence. I reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Hillis. Ms. Moore.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. So we're here today really discussing whether or not the evidence that was admitted and considered by Judge Mills here was reliable. Was it substantially trustworthy?
Now, the first question is whether Judge Mills complied with Rule 32.1b2c.
With respect to making a specific interest of justice finding on the record, Judge Mills did not do that.
Indeed. Well, isn't that a problem? The rule could hardly be clearer. It says defendant's entitled to an opportunity to question any adverse witness unless the judge determines that the interests of justice do not require the witness to appear. Right? And I gather that every other circuit that has considered this has said that the judge must make a finding on the record at the time. Is there any circuit that has excused such a finding?
No, I don't believe so, but I do believe that...
Then the only remaining question, I take it, is whether this argument was preserved in the district court. And Mr. Hillis said that he drew the district judge's attention to this rule. You agree with that?
He did draw the judge's attention to the specific rule,
okay.
Yes.
Well, there we are. You have a rule calling for a specific finding. Other circuits have reversed for the lack of that finding. We couldn't affirm here without creating a conflict with a bunch of other circuits. And the issue was preserved for decision.
I would say to that, Judge Easterbrook, that what we have here and what in this court talked about this in the Kelly decision as well.
Kelly did not mention this rule.
That is true.
And I went and looked at the briefs. Didn't mention the rule because it hadn't been raised until the reply brief. And you remember that Kelly said, that's too late. We're not ruling on it.
Yes.
So Kelly has not ruled on this issue, and here we have a case where the issue has been preserved.
That's exactly right. But here's what I would say about Kelly and the court's reasoning in Kelly. And what this court said in Kelly is, look, we want, and I understand that it wasn't Rule 32. It was the Confrontation Clause issue.
The rule is different from the Due Process Clause. Rule gives defendants more rights than the Constitution does. Perfectly normal for rules to do that.
But the point from Kelly is still well taken, and that is there are situations, so let's assume it's error not to make the finding. There are situations where we can tell from the record, this court is perfectly well positioned on this record to make that determination.
It's perfectly clear that this requires the district judge to make a ruling, and we then review the ruling for abuse of discretion or plain error. It doesn't call on the Court of Appeals to make its own ruling.
No, but it does allow, this record allows this court, is what I'm saying, Your Honor, to make the finding to determine whether or not there was reliable evidence.
This is not the way appellate review works. It's not what the U.S. Attorney urges us in other cases. The Court of Appeals should just ignore the district court, make independent findings. Can it be the position of the Department of Justice that we just ignore the district court's findings under rules like this?
Sometimes, go ahead.
This is our view. Our view is that on this record, this court is perfectly well positioned to determine whether or not this evidence was sufficiently reliable in this case. We're not arguing that Judge Mills wasn't obligated to make a finding. We're not arguing that there wasn't error in the sense that he didn't make an explicit finding. That's what this court said analogously in Kelly.
The rule does not require a finding about whether the evidence is reliable. It's not what it says.
That's right. But this court and other courts have said when we're looking at the interests of justice, you look at that application note, the court is to balance the defendant's right of confrontation against the good cause for not presenting the testimony.
The problem is you've got all these facts that provide a perfect basis for the district court to make such a finding. Mm-hmm. And even trying to save it and say it's harmless error because the court said she was afraid, that was a statement that was sort of buried right toward the end of the sentencing. So it wasn't done in the context of making a real...
It wasn't done at the time, Judge Williams, but the prosecutor, as an officer of the court, did say earlier in the transcript...
I know you represented that she was afraid, and there were a couple things that were said about that, but there was no specific tie-up.
And, you know, the way this played out, as you'll see from the transcript, is that the issue was teed up for the court, and the defendant made the argument, we need to have Pamela Pritchard here testifying. The government responded, no, we don't, because we have reliable testimony here. And that reliable testimony is going to include the firsthand observations of the officers who arrived immediately on the scene, their observations of both the injuries and the fact that Pritchard was there the first time and fled the scene, had to be apprehended, and that they saw him leaving the scene in his black car the second time. We also have, as you pointed out, Judge Williams, all of the non-hearsay or the exceptions to the hearsay rule with respect to the medical evidence, with respect to the comments that she made to medical personnel. We have the excited utterances. It's just not right to say that that argument was forfeited, because the case that the defendant cites for that proposition is a case where the government failed to raise an argument on appeal in the Fourth Amendment context. We raised that argument here. We prevailed in the district court. We can support that finding on anything that finds, you know, that is supportable in the record. Certainly these were excited utterances when the police officers showed up. So the issue is teed up for Judge Mills. Judge Mills hears the government's response to the defendant's raising of the issue that we're going to present this reliable evidence, and he says, your objection is denied, and then he hears the evidence. In the course of pronouncing sentence, he did say, Pamela Pritchard is so afraid, she's too afraid to come here and testify. But even had that not been a part of the record, this court has made clear, and other courts discussing the good cause analysis
Why
have made clear.
Why didn't you ask the district court to make the finding that the rule calls for?
I can't speak to why the prosecutor did not ask for an explicit interest of justice finding in the district court. Again, I think that this is a situation where the parties felt like the issue was teed up for the judge. The judge ruled.
Yeah, but the judge doesn't do what the rule requires. You hope somebody would call it to his attention.
Absolutely.
This is a bulletproof case in which an error was pointlessly, needlessly introduced, easily preventable.
I agree, and it's a less than perfect record, and of course
then the whole point of 32 is sort of a catch-all, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so when you are dealing with sort of catch-all provisions, to me that's when you're in high alert in terms of the good cause, because that's sort of a savings. It's there for situations like this where the victim might be totally in fear, and so once the court makes that finding, it's crystal clear. I mean, that's the whole point. So I'm just saying the prosecutor should be alert when you get to the use of that rule.
Well, actually, there are several cases pending before the court right now on these supervised release revocation hearings where the issue is whether or not the findings were properly made and whether or not the parties queued up
several. Are there cases other than Wallace?
There's Jordan as well, which is the companion case to Wallace.
Was it argued with Wallace, or is it being briefed separately?
It was briefed and argued separately, and both of those cases have been briefed and argued.
All right. Which, do you happen to know the docket number of Jordan, so we can find out what's going on there?
I know that I actually briefed both of those cases. I argued Jordan. I didn't argue Wallace. Wallace was argued.
Would you file, then, a letter with the court as quickly as possible telling us what this other case is? Because your brief didn't mention that, did it? Wallace, we were alerted to. One of the things we need to do when we have multiple cases presenting the same issue is coordinate among the panels, and we need to know all of the panels that have this issue.
Your Honor, the reason that we didn't reference either Wallace or Jordan is because that they present slightly different issues. I mean, they're all, I was responding to Judge Williams' concern about sort of making sure that the judge makes the appropriate findings and cueing the judge to that. And I was going to say, by the way, the case is Keith Jordan, but I'd be happy to file something. Judge,
what's the name of that case?
Keith Jordan. It's the companion case to Wallace. In other words, it's the co-defendant in the Wallace case. In that case, unfortunately, the government stated that hearsay was admissible and didn't focus the court at all on the reliability aspect of it. So we're a little ahead of the game here in terms of at least appropriately focusing the inquiry for the court. Now, nobody went the final step and asked for the interest of justice finding, but again, we would really encourage you on this record. The evidence here is just so strong and so reliable, and we have so much evidence that isn't hearsay at all, and so much other evidence that falls under exceptions to the hearsay rule, that it's, you know, clear from the record that the judge had substantial, reliable evidence to find that the defendant committed the allegations that he violated his supervised release, and certainly by a preponderance of the evidence. So we would encourage you to find any error here harmless on this record. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Bowen. Anything further, Mr. Hillis? You happen to know what the Jordan case is?
I do, Your Honor. Page 8 of the defendant appellant's brief, we cited Wallace. Page 17, we cited the Jordan matter. It's case number 13-1488.
13-1488?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We will track this down and make sure that the court manages not to talk out of multiple sides of its mouth at the same time.
Judge, with respect to points for rebuttal, I begin with the prosecutor stated to the court, Mrs. Pritchard didn't come because they thought they could prove the case without her. It wasn't because she was too afraid to come. So this case is different from those cases, and there's a Ninth Circuit case that talked about a person being in such fear that they can't come to testify. That was never the argument here, and that was never the case here. Mrs. Pritchard elected not to come, and the government elected not to have her. As for the
harmless error analysis, which she'd like us to adopt. I mean, she'd like us to apply harmless error. Why shouldn't we?
This is not harmless error. The rule required to make a finding, we pointed that out, and the judge didn't make the finding. The government proceeded at its peril. We asked, because the government knew what the rule required, didn't make the necessary efforts, we asked the record not be expanded on remand. They are limited to the evidence they presented because they knew what they should have brought, and they didn't bring it. They shouldn't be bailed out. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.